1938, Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster created Superman, and with him, the superhero genre was born and the comic book industry was kickstarted. Now, I've been a fan of superheroes my whole life, but it wasn't until 1991, when Jim Lee and Chris Claremont relaunched X-Men, that I became obsessed. And while my obsession has dwindled over the years, this new series from the Pop Culture Bombcast is my way of reconnecting to what made me love comics so much in the first place. And I've brought my co-host and good friend Bender, who reconnected with his love of comics through our friendship more than 10 years ago. So join us as we break down the best of what each year in comic book history had to offer as we give you That Year in Comics. 2007, that's the year we're doing today.
Yes, sir.
But before we jump into 2007, we're going to take a short trip back, just 3 years, to 2004 in our last episode.
Yeah.
Because we've got an update, because you read Identity Crisis in between.
I did.
So what's your thoughts, and give that a rating on that?
I would give it a solid 4.5. So, I thought it was very, very good.
Did you agree, though, that that was a rough rape scenes for a comic book?
The whole, like, DC does dark so well. Like, they really do. Yeah, it was a tough scene. Every bad guy in there just looked either really sad or really sinister.
They look like bad guys. As Rags Morales.
Yeah, Rags Morales. I mean, Captain Boomerang?
Yeah.
Catching him looking like sad, you know, beyond his prime bad guy. I thought the art there was really good. He still had the ponytail, but he was losing his hair. You know, I loved that. The ending, though, real twist there.
Oh, yeah, yeah, with Sue, the, Sue, yeah. I mean, not Sue, but,
I forget her, Sue Dibney's the one who died, but, yeah. I didn't want to ruin, I don't know if we should ruin it, but spoiler
alert.
Well,
we did on the episode,
yeah,
we ruined it.
Is it Captain Atom?
Captain Atom.
Yeah, his wife is actually the murderer, that was a real twist.
Why can I, not, oh, Jane, Jean Laurie.
Jean, yeah.
Yeah, so.
It was good, I really, really enjoyed it, played like a really good, noir mystery.
Me and my oldest daughter were down at the Loop, and mm-hmm. we went to that new comic shop there where Star Clippers used to be.
Oh, is that gone now?
It's Star Clippers is on Washington now, I believe.
Oh.
Yeah, because they announced this big closing.
Uppity.
I don't know any of the people that own it now, but there was this big, we're closing down, we've been here forever, this big sad thing, and then like a month after they closed down, someone else has bought it, and we're moving to Washington. Oh. So I was like, okay.
Well, that's cool.
So,
two comic shops in the city is a good thing.
Yeah, no, plenty. There's plenty of comic shops in this city.
Yeah.
But
downtown.
Oh, yeah. We went into, and I almost picked up the new Justice League, which is more of a mystery now.
Okay.
And it's a universe-spanning mystery, but my point is what was cool about the Identity Crisis, like I told you when we were reviewing it, mm-hmm. for it was such a small contained story for a lot going on and a lot of people. It was a very private detective story with a bunch of superpowered people.
Yeah, I had never heard of Captain Atom before this, what I was reading here, but I'm not a huge DC guy. But it did a good job of containing that and leading into later on. Another good story that we'll talk about later on does not do a good job of containing a bunch of people.
Yeah, that happens. Yeah. So any other comments about our last episode in 2004 before we get into it?
No, I don't think so. Did anybody give us any questions? I would be shocked if they did. Any comments?
I think...
The Nerdcast guy had a lot of...
Yeah, he talks about it. He's a loyal listener to this spinoff, and he also listens to the other show too, and also Rick Dury, mm-hmm. Owner of the Beer Sauce Shop. He talks to me about it all the time. In fact, he tried to talk to me about this before we even record. He was texting me today. It's like, hey, we're recording tonight, so you'll get it. So, yeah, wait for it. But so that was 2004. But
he
like,
should have sent us some questions.
He should have answered them. He always just tells me his questions.
Yeah.
So like every time we're going to jump into 2007, we're going to hit up on what was going on in the world, the whole genre of pop culture. So I will start off with the world like I always do. Big deal, Steve Jobs debuted the original iPhone at Macworld in San Francisco in 2007.
Yeah.
I thought this was poignant and very topical. North Korea agreed to shut down its nuclear program,
which
didn't last long and feels a lot like deja vu now that we're in 2018. Campus shooter at Virginia Tech kills 32 and wounds 17. That was massive.
I left that out on purpose.
Well, yeah, after our last episode, for those that don't listen, I wrote this before.
And an 8.0 earthquake hit Peru, killing 519 and wounding more than 1,300.
Jimmy's so dark.
Yeah, but then I'm coming back because Al Gore wins a Nobel Peace Prize for his work on climate change, which would eventually lead to our,
Inconvenient Truth.
Yeah, from his documentary, An Inconvenient Truth. You got anything else in the world before I jump to music?
I got the last Harry Potter book was published.
Yeah.
Aqua Teen Hunger Force had the bomb scare where they put those little digital clocks all over Boston.
Oh, yeah. And I forgot about that.
Yeah, everybody thought that they were setting up bombs. Britney Spears shaved her head.
Well, that's music, but I get it.
Okay.
But, so let's just jump to music.
Well, hold on.
All right,
The writer's strike was a big deal. That was a
big deal. You could tie that one into movies and pop culture there on that part. But, yeah, that was a massive deal.
And Bob Barker left The Price is Right.
He retired.
Yeah.
Yeah, he retired after a long... I wonder who was longer, him or Trebek now.
Ooh, I don't know.
And Pat Sajak, another one.
That's a good trivia question.
We'll have to look it up when we're done here. So,
stay tuned.
Music. The Police reunited for a world tour after 23 years of breakup. Tenacious D released a movie, Pick of Destiny.
Well, was that 2007?
Yeah, and they've got... I think they're making a new one now. Weird Al performed his 1,000th live show in Idaho Falls, in Idaho.
Mm-hmm.
Surviving members of Led Zeppelin reunited for a show in London. That was their first time in 25 years. Not to be outdone, the equally iconic Spice Girls announced a reunited world tour. That. And a close race for the year's most popular song saw Beyonce's irreplaceable edge out Rihanna's Umbrella, Ella, A. So, good year
That song was everywhere.
Good year for earworms.
The worst song of 2007.
And this is what you wanted to lead the show with.
Was this one here. Let me see if I can get it to just speed right up to it.
Oh, Soulja Boy.
Shit was everywhere. I thought it was topical.
It does because they Superman that hoe. Which, do you know what Superman in that hoe is?
I think it's... Isn't that like you spread out on her back or whatever?
You share your life-making juice and then put the sheet on her back to make a cape.
Oh, is that what it is?
That's what I was under the impression of. I could be wrong.
I thought it was...
I've been white most of my life.
I thought it was like the doggy style, and then like you kick both legs up and you're, you know...
Both are acceptable. Yeah, both are acceptable.
Either way, it's stupid. The worst song ever.
So in sports, in a battle featuring the first ever matchup between black head coaches, the Colts whipped the Bears' ass in a rainy Super Bowl.
Oh, yeah.
LeBron would lose his first finals in four games to the Spurs.
Yep.
Movies and pop culture. TV's Merv Griffin died. Big player in TV.
Yeah.
Pirates of the Caribbean at World's End just barely edged out Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix for the top grossing film of the year.
That movie sucks.
Unbelievable that it passed up a great movie.
Yeah, that's crazy.
I would bet, though, I would go out on a limb and say J.K. got the last laugh, and her movies have made more money than those movies long-term.
Yeah, but then she put Johnny Depp in it.
Yeah, well, she's
check
like,
out the last episode.
She said, if I can't beat them, join them. No Country for Old Men, though, won Best Picture.
Can I just say real quick, that is the worst fucking movie ever. I hate it.
You know, we disagree there. I enjoyed the movie.
I hate everything about that movie.
Speaking of me enjoying movies that most people wouldn't admit to, I quietly enjoyed Stomp the Yard in 2007.
Well, I didn't know that one was on there.
Also, very underrated movie I felt in 2007, Smoking Aces.
Really? I thought that was okay.
And while 300 proved that Zack Snyder can, in fact, make a good movie, but it's rare that style and substance...
What was his first one?
Dawn of the Dead was his first one.
Oh. His first slow-motion one.
His first stylized film. But he did prove that you can use style and substance. They can go hand-in-hand. But, pertaining to the genre... Ghost Rider and Fantastic Four 2 failed to push the...
I didn't even know those were on there.
Further the genre of superhero movies. Luckily, they rebounded.
So, yes, because I grabbed a bunch of movies. Ratatouille was out there.
Big one.
Spider-Man 3.
Oh, yeah, that's a...
That
the
one
worst
also
one.
Sucks. The only one that I like of the whole series, Transformers, the first one came out
that was
year.
A good movie.
Personal favorite, Hot Fuzz.
That would be the second of the Edgar Wright.
Yes. Yeah, it was Shaun of the Dead, then it was Hot Fuzz, and then it was At World's End.
I love that.
Yeah. See, I think Hot Fuzz is the best of those three.
I think that's not the popular opinion. I bet they probably say Shaun of the Dead.
Yeah, most people do, but watch Hot Fuzz twice and you'll...
But what I was about to say, though, is even though that's not the popular opinion, that's a great argument because I love all three.
Yeah, they're great. All three of them are great. Other geek cred for that year was I Am Legend, which is not a good movie. Good book, though.
Hey, we got three people joining right now.
Oh, hey, guys.
One's my wife. She won't join us in studio, but she'll watch from upstairs.
She's just checking me out silently.
That's right.
And then Beowulf.
Beowulf. Yeah.
And then Sunshine came out, which was I thought was an underrated.
Oh, you mean Eternal Sunshine on the Spotless
Mind? No. Just Sunshine.
What was that one?
Chris, the space one.
Ooh.
It's got Captain America in it.
It's got it's also got
Cillian Murphy.
Yeah, Cillian Murphy, and that's very
it's a very underrated movie.
It's quietly a horror movie.
Yeah.
That you don't know going into it.
Yeah, but it's a good thriller.
I enjoyed it. Yeah. I enjoyed it. Yeah. They're trying to reignite the sun and they're doing experiments on very weird ending. But enough of all that. You got anything else before we jump right into some comic news for 2007?
I don't think so. That's it.
Well, let's go right into it, and I know you made fun of me a while ago for being too dark, but I will lead because I want to get all the sadness out of the way. Tragically, a very great artist in Mike Ringo died of aortic dissection at age 44. Mm. Notable works for him. He was one of the definitive artists on The Flash. Fantastic Four has had its creator-owned Telos, which was a fantasy with where animals were very much they had the human characteristics. What's that called?
Animorphs?
So whatever.
I don't know.
There's a word for it.
Yeah, I know what you're saying.
But, so there's an annual award called the Ringo Award, named in his honor, and is presented annually at Baltimore Comic Con, which is one of the original massive Comic Cons in the
cool.
world. So, yeah, it was. I love Ringo's art. And you could still scour the dollar bins for Telos, but it was beautiful. I don't even know what it was about. I remember buying them. I don't know if I ever read them, though.
Yeah.
Still good. Sales in 2007. 2007 was a pretty strong year for comic books. It was 9% up over 2006 and would be the seventh straight year at the time for growth in the industry. And I remember working at a comic shop. It was doom and gloom for the printed book.
Okay.
But it was still on the incline. All right.
So let me ask you this. Do you think that that has anything to do with Civil War coming in at the very ending at the very beginning of 2007?
No, and we'll get into the other books. I think Civil War had a big part of it, but I think it was a microcosm of epic event after epic event.
Yeah.
And they just happened to have some good ones. Civil War was a good event at the time.
Yeah.
And so there was some other stuff. So just on that note, spurring the growth was a strong start to the year thanks to the Civil War, the end in February, and then Marvel kept on pushing the envelope with the death of Captain America, which was March, which was Captain America number 25.
Mm-hmm.
Summer saw, and this is one Rich brought up and wanted to know if we were going to talk about it, saw Thor number 1, which was J. Michael Straczynski's run on Thor, which was a massively successful and critically acclaimed run. And that saw Marvel have its biggest month that in the summer since 1996, one of their single biggest months with Thor number 1. Month of September in 2007 would be the best month in the history of Diamond Comics era.
No kidding.
Yeah. Also a record high for the average cost of a comic book at the time, $3.27.
I think they're like $3.99 now.
Yeah. The year drew to a strong close in October, being pushed by New Avengers number 35. And after a slight dip in November, December capped off a great year led by Ultimates 3 number 1, which I love Ultimates 1 and Ultimates 2, and I was going balls deep into Ultimate 3 with Joe Madureira as the artist, and it's awful. It's so awful. I mean, it's only three issues because he was chronically late, and if you read them, they don't make much sense.
Yeah.
It's awful. But the top 10 books of the year, though, were in order from 1 to 10. Captain America number 25 was the number 1 book of the year.
Shocking.
Civil War number 7, followed by Civil War number 6. And it's funny that the last year we did, 2004, was dominated by DC books.
Yeah.
Here we are 3 years later, and it's almost like WCW taking over WWF's ratings. They didn't look back. Thor number 1, Dark Tower Gunslinger Reborn number 1.
That's Marvel 2.
World War Hulk number 1, Dark Tower Gunslinger Born number 2, World War Hulk number 2, Fallen Son, Death of Captain America, Wolverine Zero, and Fallen Son, Death of Captain America, Iron Man Zero. So a clean sweep for the Marvels in the top 10
of the
year. Yeah. There were 42 major comic book conventions in 2007, four Wizard Worlds that year, and they had the first ever six full countries of comic book conventions. So
six full countries?
They hit six countries
I see what you're saying.
Year.
Yeah.
And then other notables for 2007 I have. Do you have anything before we go do that?
No. I'll let you do this one.
Some other notables I had, other than the massive success of the death of Captain America, which, by the way, those that don't know, Rogers ended up dying at the hands of his then-pregnant girlfriend, Sharon Carter. We would later go on to find out she was brainwashed by Dr. Faustus. And she would lose the baby. And Bucky would go on to notably replace Captain America.
Yep.
It would be a gun-toting Captain America from there on out. Garth Ennis's The Boys was canceled at Wildstorm and then rebounded and came back at Dynamite, which had a very successful run for Dynamite. It was their biggest book at the time.
Never read it.
It's okay. I mean, it's Garth Ennis, and he's got his niche. Preacher's one of my favorite series of all time. His run on Punisher was massively successful. I think by then, though, especially at the later end of The Boys, it was just... He was almost a parody of himself. Yeah. He was doing this really raunchy humor.
Raunchy, gross stuff.
And, you know, and it's crazy to say, but maybe one of his most enjoyable books was The Pro. I even have the hardcover.
Oh, really?
And it's a parody of Justice League where they knock up this prostitute. Superman knocks up a prostitute, and she gets superpowers from it, so she's a superpowered prostitute.
That's funny.
Yeah, pretty good. Batman Legend of the Dark Knight was canceled in 2007 after 215 issues. DC tried something brand new and did a year-long comic once a week called 52.
Oh, I remember that.
United States Postal Service released Marvel stamps. The horror genre had fans have a collective nerdgasm over the release of Freddy vs. Jason vs. Ash, which was kind of big.
Oh, yeah, that's big.
And a very odd Superman Batman versus Alien Predator came out, but I believe you love this guy's art, and it was one of the first mainstream books by Ariel Olivetti.
Yeah.
If I correct me if I'm wrong, he was Loki fame. He did Loki, which was a very good story. Joss Whedon would give Buffy fans an eighth season finally in comic books. And Mighty Avengers kick off with Frank Cho art by Brian Bendis. And I believe the big sell for Mighty Avengers is Brian Bendis set out to redo how you do dialogue and word bubbles in comics.
Really?
No character or characters would have... up until then, he had never used a thought bubble in Powers and Ultimate Spider-Man.
Bendis?
Never used a thought bubble. So he used thought bubbles, but he would do them like in between regular dialogue bubbles. Mm-hmm. And I tell you what, when I was excited to see what he tried, it was awful.
Didn't like it.
No, the books weren't bad, but it was awful.
Yeah, Bendis is kind of wordy.
He does get wordy, but hey, now his wordiness is reinvigorating Superman. So DC exclusive now. Our three books that we're going to dive into, and like we say this all the time, and they're not necessarily the best of the year, but it's what stood out to us as we were thinking back, so it's kind of the ones we go with. The main criteria, and you and I had talked about this back and forth off-air, was the vast majority of the stories issues need to take place in the calendar year that we're featuring. So if it's a 12-issue run and 10 issues are in there, it counts. If it's 6 and 6, that 6 issues, if it's a contained story arc, will do.
Yeah.
So that led to us not having Next Wave Agents of Hate, which both of us can agree is one of our favorite miniseries of all time.
I love
time.
It. Anybody who is just looking for like a self-contained Marvel story, that's one to pick up. It's hilarious.
Hey, your wife has joined us.
No way.
Hi, Rachel. There's the camera.
And my shortstop of my softball team, Mike Miley. Friend.
Yeah.
But we will have to wait on that. We'll also have to wait on Civil War since the last issue came out and then, but no other issue. And there's a ton more of good stuff. 2006 will be a good one if we ever jump into
it. Really will.
But we're not doing that. No. Today's 2007. And you're going to kick off 2007 after you get your beer with what was possibly the first... What to me felt like the first major just X-Men crossover since the 90s when the X-Men were doing it and they were the juggernauts, and that would be X-Men Messiah Complex.
Yeah, it took over. It was a new X-Men.
I've got it here.
You do?
Was 13 chapters between X-Men Messiah Complex one-shots, Uncanny X-Men 492 to 494, X-Factor. 25 to 27, New X-Men 44 to 46, and X-Men 205 to 207.
Yeah.
I'll go ahead and tell you it was written by a combination of Ed Brubaker, Mike Carey, Peter David, Craig Kyle, and Christopher Yost, I've always been curious. I've always wanted to know how when they lay out these kind of crossover events, like, for instance, like when you have Civil War, in 2006, their issues 1 through 6 was all written by the same person.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All the spinoffs and the side stories were written in their respective books by someone else.
Yeah.
This, though, was a story told from all of those books
yeah.
with different writers. It's almost like they each got their own chapter.
Yeah, and if they did a great job of pulling it all together, but if you were going to break it down, I read it in the collected edition.
Yeah, a little bit later. I think you borrowed mine.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
I think so that would be this one right here.
Yeah, that would be that one right there. I think if you were to read them then, I guess maybe you could tell the difference between the story, but they mesh so well together that the only time you really can tell any real difference in the story arc and the theme
is the artist.
The dialogue is just the artist, yeah.
Which was uber legendary X-Men artist Mark Silvestri.
Yep.
I think he did the bookends of the big books, the first and last one.
Mm-hmm.
Billy Tan, who was another very good artist. Scott Eaton, Umberto Ramos, and Chris Bachalo. Who were... The latter two being very stylized, very mm-hmm. good, went on to own their own their own comics and their mm-hmm. own stuff, and yeah, I mean that was the good lineup of art and writers.
Yeah.
So that said, let's get into the plot, my man.
It is a huge plot. So this takes place directly after the House of M, which is basically
no more mutants.
Scarlet Witch yelled, "No more mutants!" And there was
what was that?
Yelled, "No more mutants!"
Okay,
mutants.
So they're cows now.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that what it is?
Mutants.
Okay. yeah. So, and there hadn't been a birth, new mutant birth since I don't know how many years or how long it had been, but basically the mutant.
It was a couple years.
Yeah.
Oh, 2005. So this is the first one written in the comics since 2005.
Yeah. So basically, mutants are on the edge of extinction, and then all of a sudden, Professor X is talking with Beast and the
Cerebro.
Thank you. I lost it for a second. Mm-hmm. And he's attacked basically with a psychic overpowered thing, and they find out that there was a mutant birth in Alaska. So Cyclops rallies the team and they take off to Alaska to
hop on Blackbird.
Yeah, to see what's going on. And when they arrive, they find a battle had already taken place between the Purifiers and the Marauders.
Marauders. The Acolytes, the Reavers, and the Purifiers were all there.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the Purifiers are basically anti-mutant church freaks. The Marauders...
Oh, you're right. I'm sorry. At this point, it's just the Purifiers and the Marauders.
Yeah. And the Marauders are basically the bad guy versions of the X-Men. They're a little bit darker, a little bit harder. They were Mr. Sinister.
Yes, yeah. Who's permanently always after the Summers.
Yes.
Whether that's Jean Grey or Scott Summers or their offspring. That's why we have a Cable and a Nathan Summers and all this stuff.
So they find out that, they find out that all these babies were killed. So this new mutant is her mutant powers are from birth right away, which is rare. They usually show up at
adolescence.
Puberty,
yeah.
Adolescence. And, so right away, Cyclops puts a team together to go after the Marauders.
Maybe the darkest thing he's ever done. He creates an assault team.
Yeah, basically a hit squad.
Comprised of Wolverine, Storm, Colossus, Angel, Nightcrawler, and they have one...
Just green light. Just do what you gotta do.
Be Wolverine.
Yeah.
Which is weird, in retrospect, putting the likes of Storm and...
Yeah, I thought Storm being on there was weird.
And
she's
Nightcrawler,
peaceful.
Who's
and,
really religious, but I guess hey, when it's after this kid, you get a chance to kill whoever you want.
Yeah, but then he does another plot with
Jamie Madrox.
Madrox, which
is my favorite. So there was a run of X Factor that Peter David wrote with, mm-hmm. and made him such an interesting character,
really?
And that was my favorite sub-story during this is Jamie's story, because for those that don't know, he could create multiple versions of himself and send them all out to live their own life and call them back and absorb them and have all of those life experiences.
Yeah, it's a cool concept, and for as many mutants as there are, that's a very well thought out character and power. And well, he basically goes and visits Forge, who has technology to
Forge has always been able to go time travel.
Yeah, he's a time traveler.
His mutant Forge's mutant power is probably one of the best. He's just super smart at inventions.
Yeah,
that's your so he's essentially Elon Musk of the mutant universe. Yeah. That's not a power.
No, just really smart.
Yeah, he could have done that without being born with a mutant gene.
Yeah, I don't know.
it's called studying.
Anyway,
Tony Stark, you know.
Yeah, basically. Either way, he finds out that with the birth of this new mutant, that there's the future split off into two possibilities. And here's where it gets kind of great for me, because so Madrox sends a version of himself to each future. And one of them is a future where this new baby kills a million humans and all of the...
not good work.
Yeah, all of the mutants are basically encamped in or enslaved in a concentration camp, and they run into Bishop. And I guess this is one of the, you know, story arcs where we meet Bishop for the first time.
Yeah,
his early life.
This is a Bishop that has none of the experiences of the... one of the series that we've talked about before in this onslaught.
Yeah.
And does not know about the X-Traitor and all that stuff yet.
Yes, yes. But they don't really, correct me if I'm wrong, they don't really touch on the other version of Madrox and where he goes. They never really touch on that, if I can remember correctly.
Well, no, yeah, I don't think so. Does he may, and I could be wrong.
Yeah.
He may end up being the villain version that starts killing other ones so he doesn't have to come back.
Well, I know as soon as he disappears that the clone or the basic first version goes into a coma.
Because of the stress of sending one through time, which he'd never done before.
Mm-hmm. So while that all is going on, Cable is running around, and he turns out that he actually has the baby.
They do. The second one does pop up. We can get it. It comes back up later because I forgot. They go through with Layla Miller. They jump in through.
But she's Layla's with the one with Cable.
Oh, is
with,
that right?
Bishop. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, it was kind of weird. Anyways, there's also a mutant dog called Predator X running around chasing people.
Yeah, which is essentially an alien predator combo that was created just to literally eat mutants.
Yeah. And then there's all kinds of crazy subplots with the new mutants going after the purifiers and Lady Deathstrike, who's running those.
Yep.
You want to take some of this?
Yeah, so then the new X-Men go to attack the purifiers base. The assault team tracks the Marauders to Alaska.
These are the young kids, the teenage kids.
And they attack them with Emma Frost's help. Yep. Back in New York, the one Sentinels are infected by Nano Sentinel and turn on the X-Men.
And attack Xavier's mansion.
Which leads a return of Iceman in a cool scene.
Yeah, that was really good.
Wolverine tells Cyclops, this is where he informs Cyclops that Cable, in fact, has the baby.
Yep.
Cyclops assumes his son used the Nano Sentinels to attack them for some reason.
Yeah.
So he dispatches a
distraction.
Yeah. So he dispatches a new X-Force. Oh, by the way, his son is Cable.
Yes.
And this would be the real bad team. Wolverine, Hepzibah, how do you say that? Warpath, Caliban, X-23, and Wolfsbane. Is a murderer's row
Is the actual kill team.
Cable walks about in Alaska with the baby, and the forgotten Predator X continues killing mutants left and right at the X-Mansion.
Yep.
Meanwhile, back in the future, Layla and Madrox discover the mutant concentration camps that you alluded to earlier.
Yep.
And they get permanently branded with an M on their face, which pops back up in a cool way in a little while.
Yeah, that is cool.
In present day, X-Force finds Cable mid-battle with Deathstrike and Reavers, Lady Deathstrike, that is.
Yes.
X-23 kicks Lady Deathstrike's ass, but Caliban is killed in the process.
Yes.
And for those that don't know, they did a version of Caliban for the old man Logan, the movie Logan.
Yeah,
which was a very cool character in that movie,
cool.
I thought. Cable steals a Blackbird and hauls ass to Texas, hoping to use his forged time-traveling device. But he gets sucker-punched by Bishop.
Yep.
And Madrox and Layla discover in the future he was going to kill the mutant messiah, thinking she was the lead reason.
The reason that they're all in concentration camps and his parents are dead.
So now Bishop gets attacked by the Marauders because this is basically a game of 21 in basketball. It's everybody against everybody.
Yes.
And they take the baby to Muri Island under Gambit's leadership.
Yes.
Once there, we learn that Mr. Sinister, who has the baby, is actually Mystique.
Yeah,
and that hiding. Mr. Sinister is long dead.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks to Rogue's touch.
Yeah.
Cerebra at this point because...
Oh, it's the second version of it. Yeah.
Is used to track Gambit and Cyclops, rescues X-Force, Bishop, and Madrox. Cyclops sends Bishop and X-Force ahead to the island in a faster one ship.
Yep.
And after they leave, Madrock reawakens after Layla uses a stolen grenade to kill his dupe, which instantly sends him back in time. But when he wakes up, he has that
all those
on his
memories,
face.
Which is really cool. That was a good scene.
Yeah, I enjoyed that. He tells the group about Bishop, and Predator X arrives at the mansion for a fight just in time with to go toe-to-toe with the new X-Men.
Which these are all young kids, for those of you who don't
know. Yeah, new X-Men at the time. So Pixie, she has teleporting ability. She teleports them to Moor Island. Cable uses the stolen ride to get to Xavier to help him.
Yep.
And he explains that in the future, the baby was a messiah who united all of man and mutant kind. So Mystique tells Gambit that Destiny, her former beau, told her about the baby and that it would heal Rogue, because Rogue's in a coma at the time.
Yeah, that's a whole thing that just pops up out of nowhere.
Yeah, and I wasn't so into X-Men at the time. I jumped back into a little with this. Mm-hmm. I did not know all that going
on. And apparently that's the whole reason that Rogue was running with the Marauders, because they had Rogue in a coma and the thing.
Yeah, who knows?
Yeah.
So she tried to save the baby by pushing its lips to Rogue's lips, but Gambit stops her, saying that Rogue wouldn't want an innocent to die for her.
Yeah.
The Marauders and Acolytes battle X-Force and the newly arrived X-Men. Professor X interrupts Gambit along with Cable. Cable gets the baby again, and Bishop walks in along with Predator X. The mutant eater chomps Bishop's arm off in a good scene, and Wolverine does what he does and kills the monster from inside out.
Yep.
Yeah, which is...
That's a pretty good scene.
Yeah, that's the way Wolvie gets shit done, man.
Yeah.
Rogue wakes up and, like a spoiled kid, disowns her mom. Mystique.
I feel like she was in the right.
Oh, she had it coming, but still, you know. I mean, that's what teenagers do. They wake up, even though she's a little older than that. She leaves Gambit along with her and Mystique's memories.
Yeah, she's got to be. She's got some time to think.
Right. Cyclops demands that Cable hand over the child, and Professor X flip flops like he's known to do year after year. Professor X may be the worst leader in all of comic books.
Yeah, and That's one good thing about this book. There's plenty of good about this book. It really does work really well. But Cyclops taking over and basically saying you've lost all your credibility.
Chris Oath chimed in that when our beer was empty, we needed a mutant beer refilling power, which is a great power.
That would be amazing.
Scott then sees what everyone's been fighting for when he looks in the eyes of Hope. Obviously, at that point, we are to know that Hope is essentially Jean Grey reincarnated.
Yeah.
So to speak. And a pissed off Bishop takes Scalp Hunter's gun and shoots at Cable, who time slides into the future. The man that once knew of the X-Traitor misses Cable and smokes Professor X right in the head.
Yep.
So, of course, Cyclops responds with a powerful optic blast that just kills Bishop, or wipes him out, doesn't kill him.
Yeah, which kind of is lazy writing, because Bishop's whole power is to absorb energy.
Yeah.
So you think it would have just been like cool things.
I think it kind of overloaded him. Was the
gimmick. You can't overload him, but it seems lazy.
So after Professor X is shot, his body is teleported away with Cyclops away as Cyclops officially disbands the X-Men.
Yeah.
Which has happened before. Yeah. Flash forward to the future, and in the epilogue, Cable appears, baby in arms, and states that the hard part is just getting started. The aftermath would see Cable get his own series, which would replace Cable and Deadpool, which we've talked about on here.
Yep.
And following his adventures on the run to try to raise the baby, whose name is Hope, as I mentioned, and keep him away from Bishop, who's hot on their heels. The next story arc would be Divided We Stand, which would immediately follow this. There was a sequel titled Messiah War by Craig Kyle, and in a third part, called Second Coming. Apparently, Craig Kyle wanted to see this as the ultimate trilogy for X-Men. It didn't play out that way, but that's essentially what Messiah Complex was. Good art, convoluted at times, cool moments at times, like all X-Men stories seem to be.
But it's complicated and is... go ahead and finish your...
That was all I was going to say.
So, what I liked most about this is there's a lot of cool mutants in it. And that's the same thing that I don't like about it, because there's a bunch of scenes where I'm like, who the fuck is fighting who and who's good
if you remember,
and who's bad?
One thing that House of M did and one thing that this was kind of still reeling from is what Grant Morrison did when everybody was a mutant.
Yeah.
You know, he just went all willy-nilly and met mutants everywhere.
And that's the good and the bad of this, is there is a lot of really cool characters, and a lot of them get a chance to shine, but some of them that you want to see more of don't get a chance to shine.
Unless you followed their other books eventually.
Yeah, but overall, I thought the whole story was spectacular and played like a fun on the run movie.
Well, so what is your 6-pack rating of this story?
I'd give it a 5. It's a solid X-Men for it. It could have been a way more confusing.
I'm gonna go 4.
Okay.
You know, not my favorite X story, but definitely not. It was a solid reattempt to capture the '90s magic with the X-Men. And
I thought it did a good job.
It did have its moments. I mean, you know, you have Cyclops make command decisions.
Mm-hmm.
You have Professor X do something or may have one big moment, and you package it around a bunch of Wolverine stuff, and you got an X story.
Yeah.
And everybody else falls into line, like your setup role, like if you're a relief pitcher before the closer and stuff like that. So
the good guys are the good guys, the bad guys are the bad guys.
Yeah, I'd give it a 4, but I would recommend that everybody read it once. I've probably only read it, and this probably was my 3rd time reading it, so it's not a book I've revisited a whole bunch.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot going on, so it's not like an easy...
And so much has been has gone on since and before that it's hard to pinpoint when you... If you just pick it up and read it again, it's hard to pinpoint... What was exactly going up on the X? But I enjoyed it. I mean, that said, oh boy, I think I'm out of order. What just happened here?
Yeah, you kind of threw me off because I thought we were talking about Hulk first. But
we were.
Hey, you called an audible. I went with it.
I don't even see where my Hulk is. So,
either way,
I am upset. That means I failed to print one page of my notes. That means I'm gonna wing it, man. I'm gonna wing it.
I can wing it.
So let's just dive into that. Let's dive into World War Hulk. Speaking of disappointing, or at least revisiting a story, World War Hulk was the direct result of what I consider, and I think you were going to ask this question before we started on the podcast, was there ever really a good Hulk story?
I was going to ask that.
So World War Hulk follows what I consider one of the best. Planet Hulk was unbelievably good.
Yeah.
And there's some other ones like Future Imperfect, which is only a 2-part series, which I loved a lot. George Perez and I believe Peter David, great story. But Planet Hulk was a massively successful book written by Greg Pak, I believe.
Yeah, I think he did. It's got to be his best work on Hulk. Somebody can correct us, me if
I believe
wrong,
it is. I believe it is. And so he followed this up. And so I read it first when we decided to do 2007. Like I'd said before, those that haven't heard, I was sitting upstairs. We didn't know what year we were going to come up with. And I said, Missy, pick a year between 2000 and 2015. And she goes, 2007. I said, that's it. We're going to do it.
Yep.
Looked it up, and I was like, oh, yeah, World War Hulk, one of my favorite characters, period. So I went back and reread it first. And we'll give our rating at the end, but a little disappointing. But here's how it breaks down, essentially.
Okay.
So Hulk is on his way back with his war bond, which is the characters Meek and Korg.
Yeah, Korg.
I forget the guy has the old power. I forget his name.
I'll look him up. Keep going.
And Hulk is enraged because he not only was sent to that planet, so he thought, by the Illuminati, he also was under the impression that the Illuminati sent a nuclear weapon that killed his wife, the lead, that he became the savage king of this planet.
Yes. After Planet Hulk, he's the king.
Yeah, he ruled. He took it by hand, and by force, and brought peace
to the land.
Yeah, and they had a son that he didn't know about.
Yes,
we'll get to that.
Yeah,
but
she was pregnant.
Was pregnant at the time and blew up and died, and so he was under the impression that they did it. So they had their ship and they decided to come back. That's the first part of the disappointment. It's a very, very cheesy scene where he is on the bow of the ship practicing swordplay as it hurls through space after. I
didn't catch the practicing. I thought he was getting ready to just jump. What I saw it as he was jumping off to literally fight. He couldn't wait till the ship lands. He's just going to jump to the moon.
Let's just assume that was it, too. Still retarded.
That was stupid.
Because they see it. They're like, he's out on the bow, you know, preparing. And so he's just going through katas or something, whatever it is.
Maybe he was meditating.
Whatever, it was awful.
Hulk doesn't meditate.
By the way, we should say that not only did Greg Pak write this, but it was illustrated by John Romita Jr., who is a great artist, famous legendary artist.
I just didn't from like legendary the art, though.
It's not his best work. I think his best work is arguably either a Punisher or maybe Daredevil, A Man Without Fear.
Yeah.
I think that's probably my favorite work of his.
Yeah, I'll give you that. This felt
Kick-Ass was very good. He did Kick-Ass. It was very good. Speaking of feeling rushed, so my favorite moment of the whole series takes place in the first one. Like you said, he gets to the moon.
Just ended there.
Black Bolt, who's my second favorite Marvel character, greets him on the moon. And those that don't know, Black Bolt has the ability to destroy planets with his voice.
Yeah.
And him and Medusa are on the planet waiting for Hulk to arrive. And she essentially says, Hulk, do you not know that my husband has beat your ass before?
Yeah.
And he's willing to do it again. And Hulk's like, well, there's no talk this time. And then, you know, Black Bolt opens his mouth and he says, stop, and destroys Hulk, so to speak.
Yeah.
And Hulk then jumps from the rubble and says, I didn't come here for a whisper. I came to hear you scream. And he beats the shit off panel, which was the way to do it,
because
this is the very first fight. Beats the shit out of Black Bolt, who is one of the heavy hitters.
Yeah, he's basically one of the most powerful.
He's got the
second most powerful, top five most powerful.
His voice is arguably one of the most powerful weapons in the universe.
Yeah.
And he's also super strong, durable, and a good and a great military leader, great leader. He's what everybody wants a president to be.
Yeah.
Quiet, lead by example. Complete opposite of 2018.
Yeah.
But so the Hulk, they've got these collars that were used on them in Planet Hulk that kept them minding. And Thor Ragnarok, for those that don't know, they used that little chip. But essentially, it's the same thing. So he puts it on him, and they arrive on Earth, and he's got a big projection that so people in New York can see, and he announces that, you know, Captain America, or not Captain America,
the Illuminati.
I'm sorry, the Illuminati, who is... Doctor Strange, Reed Richards, Iron Man, who else?
Doctor Strange, Reed Richards, Iron Man.
Namor, was he one?
No.
Professor X.
Professor X and
but he doesn't play
Black Panther.
But he
they,
really,
neither one of them were there.
Right.
They never played a role in sending him
They were against it, sending him off planet.
So it's basically just Black Bolt, Tony Stark, Doctor Strange, and Reed Richards are the ones that he's really after.
So he gives them an ultimatum. All those people turn themselves in, or he's going to take over the world.
Yeah.
And he
I think he starts with destroying Manhattan.
Manhattan. And he holds up Black Bolt to prove, like, I'm not here to fuck around this time.
Yeah.
I'm the Hulk. What follows is a series of encounters with Doctor Strange, and here's where it essentially falls apart for me, too.
Yeah.
They actually sloppily write this in.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we just send him somewhere using your magic powers? We can't do that. We did that once, and this is why we've got this situation. Send him somewhere where he can't come back. Send him to Sutor. Send him to hell.
So instead, you allow yourself to become possessed by one of your greatest enemies and become evil and fight Hulk. And basically sacrifice a bunch of people that he has to turn around and save.
Yeah,
and then realize you're an asshole and let him beat the shit out of you, too.
Before that, though, he tries putting him into an ethereal plane, which I guess he forgot, but it's something I remember because I remember the old Marvel role-playing game from the early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Hulk has the ability to see ethereal planes.
I didn't know that.
He can see other worlds and stuff like that that exists simultaneously around him. It's just something. So he sees what he's doing, and he reaches out and crushes his hands, therefore crushing him.
For a second time.
Yeah. So that's
That's the ultimate, like, fuck you move,
that's plot point one that I don't like.
I mean, okay with the hand crushing.
Yeah, no. I'm just mean the fact that they could have just teleported him away.
Yeah.
But they didn't. They choose to go head-to-head.
I mean, it's a comic.
Yeah, and Tony Stark decides to go head-to-head with his new ultra-souped-up Iron Man suit.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert, it does not work.
Nope.
So he gets trapped. Another good scene is the Fantastic Four fight where he whoops Thing, because they always have had toe-to-toe before.
Yeah.
The Thing has no chance at this enraged Hulk. So those also that are listening that don't know, the madder Hulk gets, the stronger he is. Well, this is the maddest he's ever been.
Yeah.
So we think. And he hands it to the Fantastic Four, and what I like is he essentially just stretches Reed until he finds his stretching point. Like, he's going to break if he keeps stretching. We've never seen it. We just think Reed's indestructible. But turns out if you keep stretching him, you'll
find his end.
Yeah, and then he puts a little thing around his neck. Another bad plot point. Why couldn't he just skinny himself up and
slide
it off of it? Yeah. Kind of weird.
Lazy riding.
So
at the same time, though, Sue Richards is trying to talk Sentry into coming in and taking care of this.
Sue and the president and Tony, and they've all went to the Sentry. And so for those that don't know, Sentry is a ripoff of Superman for Marvel. But they give him this plot device that he has multiple personality disorder, and his dark personality is even more powerful than his light, and it is ultra scary. And there's a history that the Sentry and Hulk are best buds. Mm-hmm. And the Hulk, because of the childlike rage the Hulk has always been scared of Sentry's dark half, the Void.
Yeah.
It could cause him paralysis, fear. Kind of like the newest Infinity War movie.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's all. That's at the end of every book. It's like they go and peel the Sentry, and he won't, because he's got agoraphobia at the time.
Yeah.
He won't. He's scared.
Won't leave his house.
Yeah, scared to go outside. So all of this is going on. Rick Jones decides to get into it and try to talk sense into Hulk and things like that. Hulk's oldest friend. Yeah, his oldest buddy in the world. The guy that Bruce Banner saved and caused the gamma radiation to turn him into Hulk.
Later turns into A-Bomb, I believe.
Yeah, a version of the Abomination. Mm-hmm. So Hulk ends up getting all these guys in their thing, and he basically says, here's what happened to me, and now it's happening to you. You're going to battle Last Man Standing. Yeah. And they're in Madison Square Garden with the roof tore off.
It's so cheesy.
It is very cheesy. Ugh. So they start to battle and stuff and all that stuff. Well, of course, the Sentry shows up.
Yeah.
So Sentry shows up, and they have an epic battle.
Mm-hmm.
And it's done okay. It's not the best.
Yeah, they basically fight themselves back to their human form.
Yeah, they fight till both of their energy is completely exhausted.
Yeah.
And Sentry is unable to stand up, and Bruce gets up. Which I call a win for Hulk. But he's so mad that even the Void can't scare him. Like, Sentry has a calming ability over him, and it doesn't work. So that happens. Well, unbeknownst to us, Meek, who is one of Hulk's war bond, is unable. It turns out he's the one that caused the bomb.
Yeah, he didn't like the fact that Hulk was now promoting peace after he took over the planet violently.
Yeah, because he saw what they did and he proved his point and he stopped.
Yeah.
And Meek didn't like that.
Meek wanted him to still take over and just destroy, be a destroyer, what he is.
Yeah, and he confessed to doing the bomb.
Yeah. So then Hulk destroys.
Yeah, he pounds on Meek.
Yeah.
Well,
I think he kills him.
No. So Meek picks up the staff and goes to kill Hulk.
Yeah.
And Rick gets in between.
Oh, that's right.
And it kills, so to speak, kills Rick Jones. So where I said this was the maddest Hulk had ever been, Hulk, he goes one step beyond, and he pounds Meek into puddle.
Yeah.
And Meek saying, yes, this is what I want.
Mm-hmm.
And the Hulk is so enraged, and here's my last, second to last major complaint, that he's power stomping the planet. And he's going to break it in half just by power stomping.
Yeah.
And somehow he's emitting gamma power when he stomps. It's just badly done.
It's really stupid.
And Iron Man, who is got his second win, they got the collars off of him.
Yeah.
Has a ultimate solution. He's got a super-powered laser, which, for my anime friends, is completely ripping off the animated and comic version of Akira.
Okay.
That's how they kill
Akira. I didn't know that.
They use a big superpower satellite, and you have to get close to so it can pinpoint it. So Tony, a naked Tony, says, on my mark, fire, and he gets close enough to the Hulk, and he jumps by, so it hits him, and we're under the impression that it kills him.
Yeah.
But it doesn't. David Banner's just...
Yeah.
He's trapped in a
Bruce,
little...
Bruce, not David.
Bruce, yeah. Same thing. David Bruce Banner.
Yeah, they played the same guy.
Well, it was the movie, the TV show versus the comic. And they end up trapping him in a little container that's glowing red. And I think...
They imprisoned him and the rest of the Warbound underground. Like you said, though, that's just... Why wouldn't they have just done that in the beginning? Like, you guys are the smartest people on the planet. You couldn't figure out how to get him to stand next to you for 1 second?
Yeah.
Get the fuck out of here.
Jibber jabber. Hey, well, Tony fought him. He could have just shot him. The fact that they were trying to reason with him, and this is someone they had already decided a year earlier to shoot him off the world.
Yeah.
Because there was no reasoning with him.
Yeah, but he came back, he could talk better.
And angry.
Yeah.
And I tell you. Now, me rereading this, going back and reading.
So when did you first, did you read it in 2007?
Oh, I had a comic book store. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, I was getting them in there. Okay. I was very excited every week. They were Michael Turner covers. You know, I loved it. And the problem is, though, so at the time when I read it, I thought it was a 6. And I got done with it, and I was like, oh, man. And then I went back and reread it again. It's like, it was more like a 5. Well, reading it now, it's a 3.5.
Yeah.
I'd give it a solid three.
This is the Michael Bay of comic books. Like, if you're 12, this is definitely a 6 for you. It's everything you want. It's Hulk beating everybody up. It's, you know, big, awesome fights and little to no plot. But it's just when you go back and think about it, like there's way better stories. There's we covered on better stories this.
Yeah, this is this is not the worst story that we've covered.
No,
that would be Marvel versus DC.
Yeah,
and
although that might have had a better plot,
Heroes Reborn.
Yeah,
those were. I still think those were more awful than this.
Yeah, they were.
But you know, this did have a lasting impact, though. There was a lot of things that spun off this, like. A-Bomb. We got A-Bomb. I believe we got Red Hulk after this.
Yes, which was a pretty good character.
Yeah, General Thunderbolt Ross. Yeah, is the matter he got, the he burned.
Yeah.
He got more heat. He emitted more heat. And he was essentially almost a Hulk left for power with a brilliant military mind.
Yeah.
And then what else did we get from this? We got the War Bond became a normal group of characters for a while. Korg. We got Thor Ragnarok, which is arguably one of the top three or four Marvel movies, I think, which is crazy that we can say top three or four, that there's that many now.
Yeah.
120 movies, I think.
I think it's closer to 18. But
I do recommend you reading it, but more so, and we're not going to get into the why, I recommend you reading the previous year's Planet Hulk, which was unbelievably good.
Beta Ray Bill!
So, yeah. So, anyway... That was World War Hulk, and I don't know why. I hope I did a good enough job in spite of losing my notes. I've read it enough.
I think we basically got the... I think we had more detail there than they put into writing
it. Quite possibly. Yeah, because it did really feel like it was just moving scene to scene and fight to fight. It was fight, couple of exposition scenes, fight, 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 couple of scenes, fight, fight, fight. End game.
And that's that's kind of my problem with like a Hulk exclusive book is that you just want to see him beat shit up.
You're not a big fan of the Hulk Superman super powerful guys that shouldn't have a way to beat him.
Yeah.
I get it. But I love the Hulk and they've done it. There's been some guys like Peter David's epic run on the Hulk. There's been some great stuff written. Greg Pak's run. Yeah. This was not one of them.
No. Oh, and we didn't mention his son comes out of the scar.
Oh, yeah, that was an epilogue scar, yeah.
Yeah.
Who is also... And this is a bitch that you could always use with any comic. Anytime something new happens with a character, like they have an offspring or they have a new villain...
They hate their parents?
Well, yes, but it's also... And they're more powerful. And he proved, and if you even read what Scar's do, yeah, he is actually more powerful. No, he's not. He's not. He gets beat up by his dad in the comic. I mean... Hulk is the strongest one there is, period. And you don't have to keep making other characters. Now, he has that caveat that if you get him before he gets too mad, okay. But you don't have to creep... Like, for instance, I've not read it, but there's Weapon H now. It is a Hulk with adamantium claws.
Yeah, I haven't read that yet.
No thanks.
No.
I'm out. You're bothering me.
That's the run where Sabretooth is running the... X-Force or Uncanny X-Force.
Yeah. But I think, though, of all, even though this was frustrating, the biggest takeaway, and it was more to do with Planet Hulk, but we did get to create, I mean, those both of these stories together gave us Thor Ragnarok, which was awesome.
Mm-hmm. So thanks.
Yeah. So good job, Greg Pak and Marvel. But that's
I'll give it a solid 2.5.
2.5. Oof,
I really just didn't like it.
I get it. But I think let's talk about this next book, and this is the last book we're going to cover. This is by far, and congratulations, Dark Horse. This is the first non-Big Two company.
I was
going
to say that. That was the thing that I wrote down.
Non-Big Two. First one. This would be the Umbrella Academy, which is, I want to start with the art, Gabriel Ba, which is amazing art. I can't stress how beautiful the art is this. And also amazing covers by James Jean. And the reason I started with them, because the guy that wrote it, this would be a debut for the writer into comic books, who is the lead singer of My Chemical Romance. It's Gerard Way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, without
glad
getting...
Glad you said it. I would have said Jared.
I just know.
I know. I would have said it right.
I got daughters. we actually have a friend who has a daughter up the street, and she's really into him. So. Yeah. But I will say this. Without giving the review yet, this is a home run for your first outing.
Yeah, it won the 2008 Eisner Award Best Finite Series. Which is spectacular. But
Limited Series, essentially. So the first six issues of the story arc is what we're going to call, which was the first series.
Uh-huh.
It's called Apocalypse Suite. It ran from September 07 into one issue went into February 08. Essentially what the Umbrella Academy is seven superpowered children who were immaculately born to women that were shown no signs of being pregnant.
Yes.
And I love that's my favorite first scene in the book. When it's a intergalactic wrestling match between a superpowered Hulk Hogan type character, and he gives an elbow drop to an alien, and 43 women give birth.
Yeah,
that didn't know they were pregnant.
That's that's pretty weird.
Yeah, it's a
which
good
sets
segue.
The tone.
Yeah. So this rich, super powerful inventor and adventurer who happens to be an alien wearing human skin, a la Edgar in the Edgar suit in Edgar suit from Edgar. Men in Black.
The skin's on wrong.
Sir Reginald Hargreaves.
Or the monocle.
He sets out and they don't really explain it. There's a lot of stuff that's very mysterious, no backstory, which is good. It's almost like we came in the middle of the story on this book.
Like one of my favorite things is all the detectives are chimps for some reason.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah, so yeah, we'll talk about them here in a little bit. So he seeks out to adopt the kids. He only gets 7 of them.
Mm-hmm.
And those 7 eventually would go on, and for the purposes of the story, we started a flashback when they're 10 years old. The academy is made up of number 1, which is Luther, number 2, Diego, number 3, Allison, and that's what they're referred to in the books by their numbers.
He rates them, he gives them numbers and rates them based on how much he likes them.
Right, yeah. It's a very much an earned system of love.
Yes.
Number 4, which is Klaus. Number 5, which is...
Doesn't have a name, they just call him the boy.
Yeah, and then number 6 is Ben, and number 7 is Vanya. And so this we get them where they take place, our stop and attack in Paris.
Yes.
Which the Eiffel Tower is shot into space.
Comes to life, right?
Yeah. Number
it's
5...
Super weird.
Number 5 disappears.
Yep.
And number 6 dies.
Yes.
So then we flash forward to 20 years, and we learn that the academy is completely split up. They don't communicate. Number 1, who's the team leader, is living on the moon for otherworldly threats, to watch out for otherworldly threats. And one another, can't stress enough how awesome the design for the characters are and the idea. He has now got his head has been transplanted on a Martian gorilla's body.
And they don't get into it right away.
It's just something to do with what him living in space and fighting things.
Well, he loses it in a failed mission to Mars later. But they don't get into it right away. They're just like, oh, by the way, now he's got a... He's got an alien ape body.
But it looks awesome.
It does look awesome.
So he gets a phone call in space on a normal landline that Hargreaves is dead. So he travels back to Earth for the first time in a long time. And at the same time, when he gets back, number 5 returns, who had been missing for the 20 years.
Yes.
He still looks like a 10-year-old.
Yeah,
everyone else's age.
The boy.
Yeah, the boy returns. So number 1 reunites with his sister, number 3. And keep in mind, they're not really brothers and sisters.
No,
they're all adopted. And
her name is Rumor, and her power is to basically...
Yeah, her name's Allison.
Yeah.
Rumor is what they go by. And she has an amazing power.
Yeah, her power is if she says a lie, it becomes reality.
Yeah, she can alter reality with a lie.
Yes.
And he has always had a crush on her, and she has recently divorced and has a daughter. Then they see number 4, who has the ability to communicate with the dead.
Mm-hmm.
There's number 2, who's the rebel of the team, who's got superhuman accuracy and is a badass knife fighter.
The Kraken. I love the name.
Yeah, it's a good name.
Yeah.
And after Hargrave's funeral, they talk to number 5, who has the ability to time travel. He reveals he's figured out how to time travel to the future, and he's been, for 60 years, been trying to get back to them and warn them. He says that 3 days after this funeral... the apocalypse will happen.
Yeah, and the monocle told him that he could travel to the future, but he would never be able to get back.
Right, and that's what he figured out. And but he did it, and now he's been trying to come back ever since.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, in the city, number 7, Vanya, who's an outcast because she has no powers to date, goes to the Icarus Theater, was invited, and she is offered to join the Orchestra Verdament.
Yes.
As a violin, as a violinist, the one thing she does well, play the violin.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The Verdament is a group of musicians who claim they can destroy the world by playing what they call appropriately the Apocalypse Suite.
Yep.
She refuses to do so because that'd make her a bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
The Academy then fights the Terminatus, a group of destructive robots programmed by the Academy's former nemesis, Dr. Terminal.
Yep.
Names are awesome.
They really are.
Number seven intervenes in the fight and has to be saved by number two, is holding a long-time grudge against her for leaving the academy years ago.
And she also writes a tell-all book about leaving the academy, and the rest of the siblings are not happy
with
that.
They don't talk to her. This causes a resentful number seven to return to the Icarus Theater, and she, in fact, joins the orchestra. This is where things start kicking up a notch, because it turns out that number seven is actually the most powerful of the siblings. The conductor of the orchestra experiments with her to unleash her power. And this is where we flash to number five and one of the aforementioned ape detectives, Dr. Pogo.
Yep.
Go to a cafe where number five. No, that's not Dr. Pogo.
Dr. Pogo's the butler.
The butler. Yeah. With no body.
Yeah.
Yeah. To cafe where number five is ambushed by a mysterious group of masked men carrying laser guns. He kicks their ass because he is a badass.
Yes.
Number seven dubs herself the White Violin and proclaims that she will end the world and the Umbrella Academy at the same time, which stands to reason. If you're killing the world, you're killing the Umbrella Academy.
Might as well.
Inspector Lupo, Monkey Man, investigates the crime scene where number five killed the masked men. Number one and number three admit that they love each other and they have a nice smooch.
Yep.
Number five finds Hargreaves' monocle, which allows someone to see everything about someone, and he passes out when he puts it on. The strain renders him unconscious. Stress. Yeah, the White Violin attacks the academy where they kill killed Dr. Pogo, so the monkey's killed.
Rest in peace, bro.
PETA would not love that. And then now, in the sixth and final issue, which is one of my favorite named issues of all time, Brothers and Sisters, I Am the Atomic Bomb. I am an atomic bomb.
Yeah.
Number one, three, four, and five are ready. They prepare to stop the apocalypse suite. Number two tries to kill number seven and gets emotional and can't go through with it. Number three is slashed in the throat. Rumor, she's cut. Yeah. They cuts her throat so she can't talk.
Yeah, she's essentially powerless.
And number one takes her to a nearby hospital, leaving number two, three, and five to continue the fight with the Orchestra Verdament, or Orchestra. Number five shoots seven in the head, but she lives. Number three uses telekinesis to stop meteors from falling to Earth, thus preventing the threat of the world's end. In the epilogue, we learn that number seven remains paralyzed. Number three is never able to talk again, therefore is a normal person. One, two, four, and five then return to the academy to find it destroyed. So that's it. That's the story in a nutshell.
Yes.
I promise you, if you pick it up and read it, there's so many nuanced little things and quirky. It's very quirky. Things about it. I remember near this time, Casanova was another book that I loved.
Similar art.
Yes, in fact, the same artist. And Gabriel Bá did both of them. But that one was, who was that? That was not Brian K. Vaughan.
J. Michael Straczynski?
No, it was a Kansas City local writer. I can't think of his name off the top of my head right now. But anyway, they were both very, very out there books, but very different. The one was very psychedelic, and this one was just...
Fun. It was an odd, fun book.
Very fun book. Like you had said, it won the 2008 Eisner Award for Best Limited Series. It also, in 2009, won again for having Best Collected Edition. There was a follow-up series.
Matt Fraction,
yeah. Great writer. There was a follow-up series called Dallas, which came out in 2008, and it revolved around number five's role in the Kennedy assassination.
Yes.
Its long-term impact, though, for those that don't know, they're going to debut the Netflix show this year, helmed by Steve Blackman of Altered Carbon and Fargo fame. And notable actors and actresses in it is Ellen Page and Mary J. Blige.
Yeah, I thought that was pretty awesome.
Yeah, Cha-Cha is who she is, yeah.
So, like you said, it's an odd and it's a fun book, and the art is just spectacular. Just Google Space Boy. Umbrella Academy. If you're not hooked on it right away from there, you won't be. But like just the image of him in the little space suit, the space helmet and the monkey suit and the little blaster gun, I was hooked right away. The moment I saw it, I'm like, this is the book for me.
Yeah, I mean everything about it screamed to. I loved all these pulpy noir books.
Yeah,
at the like novels and stuff, and this was very much like a 60s style sci-fi with a little bit more of a modern edge to it.
Yeah,
The dialogue was catchy. The names were very catchy, little quirky.
Yeah, like the Space Boy, the Kraken, the Rumor, Seance, the Boy, the Horror. Which I thought his powers. We didn't really get into him. They don't really get into him much there. But he basically summons monsters from his thoughts.
Yeah.
And it's usually a tentacle monster that comes out, but it's a cool fucking power.
Yeah, I mean, they're all... And what I like about it, too, is something else you don't really get into, is they don't dive too deep into the other surviving kid.
This was just all they don't mention any of the other 43.
So, and then when you see Reed Dallas, which we'll get into one day in the future, I'm sure, they bring it up again, but still, there's story left to be told.
Yeah, there's a rumor... Not the character, but there is like
because she can't talk. She can't tell anything.
That they're gonna do a third story arc.
And I hope they do. And I hope it's Ba and Wei.
Yeah, absolutely.
Ba Wei. So I'm pretty excited about it. I reread it. In fact, I finished reading it today on my lunch at work. I read the first three issues last week, and I finished the last three today. And I can't stress enough how it's a perfect culmination of good young artists, brand new writer.
Yeah.
And an original idea. And that doesn't happen often.
No. And it's it's one of those books that even if you just read this arc and didn't go on and read the second one, which I don't know why you wouldn't, but if you did, you'd be satisfied.
Yeah.
You don't need to pick up 42 other books, which is another...
That's 12 books.
Yeah. And it's nice, beautiful, collected hardcover right here.
Live stream has died, but that's okay.
Well, either way.
It probably another reason it appeals is what you just said harkens back to why we loved Astonishing X-Men.
Yeah.
It's just 12 issues and it's self-contained and it makes sense.
And that's the hardest part. Like when you talk to people, they're like, oh, I'd like to read comics. Is where do you dive in? And it's like, well, you can jump here. You can start there.
I suggest you always Google whatever character you're into, whether it's Batman, Superman, Spider-Man, whatever.
Look up their best arcs.
Just go best Batman stories. Mm-hmm. Whatever the top 10 is, just read those. You don't have to read all the peripherals and stuff. Just start there.
Yeah.
So thoughts, ratings, would you recommend it?
I would highly recommend it.
As well as would I. I believe I've done that a bunch of times now.
I'd give it a 5.5.
I'm hesitant to give it a 6 because we've done that to Dark Knight Returns and whatnot.
Yeah.
So I'm going to tell you what.
I mean, it's not a deep story.
Here's why I'm giving it a 5.5.
Okay.
Because I, in the process of drinking the 6-pack rating beers, I spilt one of them. So it only gets a 5.5 out of that. It is a solid 5.5.
It's a lot of fun.
It was enjoyable. I probably only read it three or maybe four since it came out. But it still is enjoyable today when I finished it as when I first read it. And I found myself knowing what was coming and still anticipating that next issue.
Yeah, and then just looking at the world around it. Like if you can get a book where you not just looking at focusing on what the characters are saying but looking at the art around it and the world around them and how kind of quirky that is, and you wonder why they don't mention why all the detectives are apes,
it's very
shit like that,
minimal world building,
yeah,
but very effective, and it makes you want to know what else is going on in this world big time.
Absolutely.
5.5 for me and five and a half for you. So can't stress enough. Go check it out. Check out every book we talked about. If there's anything from 2007 that we didn't talk about that you want to know, I know Rick did want us to talk about Thor, which was a very good series from Straczynski.
Did Jason Aaron take that over right away from him? Because if that's the case, there's been 15 years of strong Thor stories.
I don't think he did.
Okay.
I don't think he did. In fact, I think that Thor was canceled again after a little while. But Straczynski's run was solid.
Yeah, it was very solid.
Are we back on?
No, I think somebody just sent me a message.
Hey, you guys are off the air. I also read Buffy season 8, just because I was looking for other things from 2007, and I'm a huge Buffy fan.
Yeah, what did you think of that?
Oh, it was a good time. If you enjoyed the show, it picks up directly after season 7. Buffy and Xander are running a hit squad, basically, or a protection squad out of Scotland, and it was a lot of fun. I'm going to go back and read all the other seasons. I'd say 3. But
you liked the Buffy, so you gave it a chance.
It was just that I only read the first 6 issues.
I wish Whedon would do that a little more in depth with Serenity and Firefly. I know there's books, and I've never got into them, but I really feel like some days I should because I love that so much.
One of the other reasons I'm giving it a 3 is because he did such a good job on Astonishing X-Men, and he was kind of the story just didn't feel as deep as that one did, And I was like, he's phoning this in. But either way, it was good. It's worth checking out if you're a Buffy fan.
Yeah, I'm going to see what I missed talking about in 2007 because of that missing page. Because I usually get into more of the what was going, what other comics like characters debuted and whatnot.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna bring that up real quick. Like, so we're stalling for time with the song.
Yeah, people need to tell us what year they want to hear.
Yeah, we do definitely want to hear what.
Even if it's just the same five people who always chime in.
I don't mind. I like you guys. And by all means, please rate. I mean, I know there's people that do enjoy it. Take the time to actually rate and
let us know what we're doing right, what we're doing wrong.
So here's, let's see. I'm just going through Freddy vs. Jason Ash. We talked about that. Some of the other stuff that debuted. Boy, it wasn't really a solid debut year. I mean, I think we pretty much hit the nails on the head. So go check out 2007. Any comments, let us know. Hashtag TYIC at PC Bombcast, and then throw 2007 into it or whatever you want to do. Or if you go back and listen to their other shows, and I know you listen.
Just listen to all of them.
They're still the most downloaded episodes we do.
Yeah.
So I apologize. The live feed went off. We're going to fix that. We were so into talking about Umbrella Academy, I didn't see that it failed. So
I didn't even look over.
We'll figure it out. Anything else on 2007?
No. It was the year before I graduated college. It was a kind of a blur.
You were drinking.
Yeah, a little bit.
I never looked back.
Yeah.
So, keep reading. We'll keep doing this. We'll figure out here in the next week or two and tweet out what the next month's going to be.
And here comes Soulja Boy.
Hey, we're also, if you like the idea of
I mistimed that.
Thinking of what other kind of episodes. We're also, in order to break the monotony of these annual year reviews, like doing a career for a creator or something like that. This is an all comic related podcast, and it's always going to be called That Year in Comics. So help us out.
Yep.
Help us out. We're done.
Yeah, 93, 96, 94, 2000.